You're listening to Harrismith Radio. Hey there, I'm your host, Wayne McPhail. This episode is about native plants and a mode of transportation that couldn't be more homegrown in this country if it tried, the canoe. First up, Mark Cullen, our perennial and annuals gardening expert, fills us in on how native plants benefit gardens, birds, bees, and, well, the environment in general. Next up, James Raffin of the Canadian Canoe Museum explains how the lowly watercraft speaks to us as old and new Canadians alike. From coneflowers to canoes, all in one episode. By the way, if you want to read Harrismith Magazine instead of listen to it, you can subscribe to the print version online at harrismithmag.com. And you can find Harrismith Magazine on selected newsstands across Canada. But for now, settle in for the next half hour of Harrismith Radio. Mark Cullen has been a fan of native plants for years now. They're a favorite of indigenous birds and pollinator species, take advantage of local conditions, and help keep ecosystems in check. He chatted with me about some of his favorite native species. Here's that conversation. Mark, thanks very much for joining us. We're going to be talking about native species today, native plants. And I thought that we could start off by what seems like a really simple question, but often simple questions aren't that simple once you get the answer. What do you consider to be a native species?
Well, simply put, Wayne, a native plant species is one that existed here in North America, Canada, if you like, before the Europeans arrived. So it was here 500 years ago, and its existence was unaltered by the hand of man. That would be a native species. Understanding that even native species evolve, right? So let's say that we had never influenced the natural evolution of native species in Canada over the last 500 years. There's no doubt that they would have evolved. How precisely? Of course, we'll never know because we didn't live that history. We changed history.
One of the things that you've written about is the idea, which I thought was a really interesting idea, that not all native species are created equal. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, we mean a few things, but first of all, we mean that native species, broadly speaking, may be plants that existed in Canada before the Europeans arrived, but native species in your region could be very different from those in another region of Canada. So depending on where your listener actually lives, let's say they're in the Maritimes, they would have a list of native species to the Canadian Maritimes that would look very different from, say, a list on the prairies or, for that matter, coastal British Columbia and lower mainland British Columbia.
And let me back up just a sec, because that really brings up another question, that if we have settlers coming and there are these native species in different ways in different parts of the country, and I assume that those native species are habituated to the environment, then why didn't the settlers that came here just grow those rather than trying to grow something that was from somewhere else?
Because the settlers were themselves an invasive species, if you want to be brutally honest about it.
Yeah.
So, you know, you take, for instance, the European explorers who became settlers, as you refer to them, or otherwise, perhaps we might call them pioneers that came here and cut down the trees and changed the landscape in a very substantial way over a period of generations and hundreds of years. And now we have a very different Canadian landscape from what we had. The original prairie grasslands, for instance, are substantially gone. I believe the number is about 96% of the original prairie grassland has been converted into agricultural land and other things. So we've had humankind has had a dramatic impact on the landscape. And why didn't we, back to your question, why didn't we just grow what was here? Well, because we weren't from here. So there were Europeans who came over with seeds of plants and cuttings of plants, a tremendous effort, a lot of risk was taken to bring over plants that people were familiar with, in particular, food plants. Did they adopt other food plants that were native to North America? Certainly they did. So, you know, the native people of Central Canada, the Algonquin people, were famous, now famous, for growing corn and beans and a form of squash that was similar to the pumpkin that we grow now, only a little different. And the funny thing is, about all three of those species, they were technically imported to the northern half of North America from the southern half of North America by a variety of native tribes or nations, if you like, over a period of time. In other words, none of those plants were actually native to Canada, but they were native to North America, and they became very popular agricultural crop for native people before Europeans arrived.
So let's talk a little bit about indigenous people and the plants that they would have grown apart from the ones that you've mentioned. What other ones would they have considered native, and what would they have grown them for, and what did they do with them?
Well, you know, a lot of them weren't grown the way we think of it, because we're steeped in an agricultural culture here in North America. Most Canadians think of food as something that is cultivated, but there were huge food crops that existed here that were native and existed because nature provided them. Blueberries, for instance. Blueberries were a staple in the native person's, the indigenous person's diet 500 years ago. I think of service berry or amelanchier, if you like, which is a fabulous landscape plant that produces edible berries in the middle of the summer, July. And if you leave them, like I do, because I don't actually eat them, then the cedar waxwings arrive and they make a meal out of them and I get entertainment out of it.
Right.
But a lot of people still harvest serviceberry, or if you like, on the prairie, saskatoonberry, a native. There are wild raspberries, as you probably know, and wild strawberries. There are all kinds of plants that can be foraged out of the woodlands and the grasslands and, for that matter, the swamplands around the country. A lot of that knowledge is resurfacing now, and there's a resurgence of interest in foraging that didn't exist to the extent that it does now anyway, a generation ago.
I want to touch on the indigenous people a bit more, because there are some groups that have started greenhouses that are particularly focused on native plants. Can you talk about that for a bit?
Well, there are, and if you go to our website, we provide a list of them, some that we've written about recently in some of our work. When I say we, I mean my son Ben and I, and
right.
He's done some research as well as myself. So between us, we have some shared knowledge about what's currently going on out in the marketplace. And I think it's very exciting. What distinguishes the native plant producer today from the native plant producer of, say, 20, 30 years ago, is that substantially they are using a locally seed source product. In other words, they are producing plants using locally sourced seeds from native sources. So take a tree, for example. Take a white pine, right? Ontario's official tree. A locally seed source white pine would have sourced, that nursery would have sourced their seeds from local native pine, and they would be growing their pine stock, their young seedlings, from the seeds of those local pines. This is being done to a much greater degree than ever before, because there's suddenly a greater realization through science and an appreciation generally that those plants that are locally seed sourced and then not shipped across the country, but sold rather locally, perform better and are better for the environment.
And necessarily if you've got something that is indigenous to a Carolinian forest, for example, you can't bring that into your, necessarily bring those kinds of plants into your backyard and expect success all the time, right?
Well, that's true. Let's face it, especially listeners that live in the urban environment where we've created something really kind of special. And when I use the word special, we're kind of loosely, we've created a hostile environment for a lot of native plants in the environment that we're familiar with in our cities. We basically have created heat sinks, which have made the environment hostile to a lot of native plants that otherwise might have grown there. And of course, there's climate change. So every few years now, Agricultural Canada is changing the zone map because our climate is changing and we are having longer, hotter summers, and often drier as well. So there's a lot that's changing today that changes the face of the native plant landscape.
So thinking of taking stuff out of the natural habitat and bringing it into hothouses or nurseries or people's backyards, I mean, some people, I think, oh, this is great. There's native plants out in the woods. I'll just go and pick them and put them in my backyard, right? And my understanding is that's not really such a good idea, right?
Generally speaking, it's not a good idea. First of all, there's a privacy / legal issue. And if you're removing young seedlings from your own real estate, that's one thing. If you're removing them from public property or crown land or a conservation area, then I think that's literally illegal. So there's that to deal with. And then, is it a good idea? Well, let's say you do own some land. In central Canada, a very common thing is the cedar hedge, of course, and the white cedar that we generally use for cedar hedges, not always, but we more than any other cedar species, is the white cedar. That almost always just is dug from a native stand, a natural stand, rather, of white cedar and replanted on a person's property. Well, it works very well. I can't argue that that's a bad idea. It's probably a good idea as long as, here's the caveat, as long as you're not negatively impacting on the home where they came from.
Right.
And you know, there are do's and don'ts to all of that, just like there are do's and don'ts to managing a hardwood woodlot or harvesting firewood. You know, there are things you do that make it reasonably acceptable to do, and then there are rules that you really shouldn't break. You end up damaging the forest itself.
So we've talked about Indigenous people's nurseries. We talked about why it's not necessarily a good idea to go in the woods to do it yourself. There's also the opportunity to go to conservation nurseries as well. Can you talk a little bit about that in terms of native plants and conservation nurseries?
Well, conservation nurseries are nurseries that are dedicated to the locally seed sourced idea. And often they're run by native people, not always, although we have a couple on our list. By the way, go to markcullen.com and sources, and you'll find, or to the recent article that we wrote for the Toronto Star on this subject, and we have a list of native plant nurseries. The conservation people tend to take a pretty pure approach to the whole idea of propagation and locally seed source and plants that are native to our area. So as an example, how we sometimes get this wrong, the purple coneflower, Echinacea purpurea, is a native plant to the prairies. And we grow it in Ontario and the Maritimes. I've seen it in British Columbia. Beautiful garden plant, great perennial, a reliable winter hardy plant. It's not native where I live in Ontario. It's not native to Quebec. It's native to the prairies. And yet, we see it sold all the time as a native plant.
So it would be hard not to talk about native plants without talking about pollination, because I know that you're a big advocate of planting plants that are attractive to pollinators. And as I was thinking through this, I was thinking, well, I understand that. But then I thought, well, wait a minute. How does a bee know that a plant is native? Like, why does it care? Nectar is nectar. Like, what's the advantage there?
Well, you know what? You're absolutely right. A bee does not know. But research tells us, and I have to admit, the research that I'm aware of tends to be more British than anything. But recent British research performed by the Royal Horticultural Society has shown that native plants overwhelmingly are more attractive to native pollinators and to honeybees as well. And by the way, the honeybee is not a native. A honeybee is a European import.
Right.
Right? So, however, having said that, there's over 300 native bee species, most of which we're not even aware of. We certainly wouldn't know the name of, but they also forage on flowers and nectar and pollen on flowers. And native species, we have learned through science recently, tend to attract pollinators better. However, there are lots of exceptions to that rule. And the RHS research was clear about that. As I recall, 15% of the species they identified as great pollinator plants, like among the best, were actually cultivars. In other words, they were hybrids or they were cultivars that had been altered by the hand of man or imported from other parts of the world and were still darn good pollinating plants. Right. So they do exist.
Does the same thing hold true in terms of what you're saying, that pollinators are attracted, native pollinators are attracted to native plants? We talked in a previous podcast about planting native species to attract birds. Is that true of birds as well?
Yes. Yes, it is. And yet, I say that, and yet I have to add, there are lots of cultivars that are not native that birds will build nests in, that they will forage insects in. But then again, there are lots that aren't. Can I give you a good example here?
Sure.
I learned recently in a book that I read that provided evidence that the red oak, the native red oak, attracts a broader spectrum of insects, which are foraged by songbirds, than any other tree in the landscape. And the number is over 400. Over 400 insects will live or feed on a red oak and become food for songbirds, where a ginkgo has none, not one.
Wow.
So, you're talking to a guy that loves the ginkgo, and I love the story of the ginkgo and the fact that, you know, in the business, we've always said, well, the ginkgo is a clean tree. It gets no diseases, no insects. Came from China. There was only one that existed in the world at the time that they first propagated it, and it's the oldest tree in the world. It goes back 160 million years. Well, that's pretty cool, but unfortunately, it doesn't really help our songbird population unless a bird happens to build a nest in it, which I suppose could happen.
I wanted to just touch on quickly the difference between native species and heritage varieties, because I think some people think anything that's a heritage variety is a native variety.
Oh my, no. Heritage is a moniker that we attach to plants that have existed for 100 years or more. And it's generally a moniker we attach to food plants. So heritage tomato varieties, for instance, could easily have originated in Europe or anywhere in the world, but they've existed for such a very long period of time that they have certain characteristics that we really like. For instance, flavor. A heritage tomato, generally speaking, is very flavorful, where a modern-day hybrid or an F1 hybrid, for instance, which you can't reproduce from seed or cut. Well, I don't think you can reproduce it from cutting even. You would have to go buy the seed or the seedling from a producer if you were growing an F1 hybrid. My point being, many of the new hybrids don't have the flavor of the heritage varieties. That's the big thing. But they also don't have the disease resistance of the newer varieties. And so we get into a conversation that revolves around production. And, you know, the tomato that you buy that was greenhouse grown in southern BC or Ontario's Niagara or Leamington area, those tomatoes are hybrids and a little bit flavorless compared to the ones that you grow in your garden that are heritage varieties.
Right. So let's wrap up by just giving folks a sense of some do's and don'ts. If they say, okay, I've listened to this conversation and Mark's right and he's right about lawn and Wayne's stupid to think it's a crap thing. Let's talk, give them some advice about how to start with native plants.
You could start in a variety of ways. You can start your own seeds, of course, and you don't need a greenhouse to do it. That would be ideal. But if you just have a sunny windowsill, the time to do that would be February, March, April. And of course, we're speaking very broadly of annuals, perennials, trees, shrubs, evergreens. Kind of choose what the native plant is that you want to grow and then think about the best way to obtain it, either as a finished plant in a 2-gallon pot from a local nursery or from a specialty nursery that specializes in retailing native plants. But don't be afraid to ask the question, was it grown locally? Is it a native to my local growing region? If I live in zone 6, is it native to zone 6, or am I pushing the zone here? Oh no, it's actually only hardy to zone 7, but you can put it in a 6 if you want. There's a hint right there that it's not native to where you live.
Right.
And so start by thinking about what it is you want to achieve in your garden. That's the best place to start. and then begin exploring sources of the plant material or the plant varieties that you wish to grow in your garden. And if we can help you, then just go to markcullen.com and go to contact us and let us know what you're thinking.
Great.
We'll see if we can help you.
Great. Thanks very much for that help. And thanks for discussing native species with me today, sir.
It's a pleasure. I really appreciate this. And Wayne, your questions are excellent. I'm sure there are listeners that have learned a thing or two here. And it's something that Ben and I are very passionate about.
Great. Thank you, sir. That was Mark Cullen, who could thrive in any ecosystem. James Raffin, the Director of External Relations for the Canadian Canoe Museum, knows how deep the relationship between Canada and the canoe goes. He's an author, outdoorsman, and collector of Canadian canoe advertising. We talked about why the canoe resonates with so many cultures and how it's a symbol of freedom, exploration, and entrepreneurship. And we touch on ways the museum will use its new building to forge and reforge links to the communities where the canoes came from. Here's our chat about canoes. James, a little while ago, my wife and I were up in Restoul Provincial Park, and I was saying to her, you know, there's nothing more heartwarming and hilarious than seeing new Canadians trying to canoe. And we saw a lot of that in the provincial park. And it really made me think, you know, for Canadians, obviously, we have this sort of ingrained association with canoes as being Canadian. But clearly people coming to Canada also have that. And they're sort of saying to themselves, I'm in Canada now, so I have to canoe.
There's absolutely no Canadian corner on canoes, if you like. Canadians love canoes in a very particular way. But, you know, quite often people who come from somewhere else are bringing with them canoeing traditions from around the world, whether it's the Pacific Rim or South America or Africa. And the canoe as a, you know, a vessel with points at both ends and open on the top is a device that they recognize. But it's also, I think, hilarious that you don't have to spend more than 2 seconds opening a magazine or wandering in the halls of an airport, doesn't matter where it is in Canada, before somebody isn't trying to sell you something with the image of a canoe from, well, health, vigor, youth, I mean, whiskey, milk, you name it, canoes have been used to sell it. And I think it's pretty easy to get to the conclusion that this geography called Canada has the canoe associated with it. And if you scratch at that even a little bit, you realize that this is a nation of rivers and is also a nation of canoes.
Right. And it also speaks to exploration, entrepreneurship, getting into the outdoors. There's all sorts of stuff associated with that freedom in terms of travel, mobility, creating businesses, creating markets that is tied up in it as well, right?
Yeah, that's an important insight. I mean, anytime anybody in this geography called Canada wanted to communicate or move ideas around and turn to local materials to meet that need, a canoe of some expression resulted, from the kayak, you know, and all of the different types of canoes, from dugouts in the west to bark in the middle to, and on it goes. And as such, you know, the canoe is kind of a mnemonic for human intention, for technology, for innovation. It really does have a lot of axes or dimensions that tell you quite a bit about not only the geography, but the people who inhabit it.
So I want to talk about technology, because you guys are, you've had a canoe museum for decades now, but now you're moving into a new building, hopefully soon. And I want to talk about how you take that historical collection, that wonderful historical collection of canoes you have, and change the visitor experience so that it resonates not only with new immigrants, but also with new technologies that are coming.
Well, I think at the core of a sort of rethinking program that we've been involved with for the last 15 years or so is the idea, or it really is built around the question, sure, these craft have stories associated with them, but whose stories are they? And that has led us back in many cases to the places, the communities from which the collection has originated. And that in turn has allowed us to explore something that's quite different from the sort of 19th century Victorian style museum where you put things in a glass case and somebody with white gloves on carefully interprets it in a very academic way. We're actually looking at who the storyteller for a particular craft might be. So that in terms of delivery of program, that means that the diversity or the type of storyteller you might encounter in the museum would be perhaps broader than it has been before, but it also might, as a result of expressions of the canoe stories in digital form, might impel somebody to perhaps go to Gibson's BC or go to Curve Lake or go to Meowpuckek in Newfoundland to learn about their canoeing traditions firsthand, if you like, outside of the museum. And that totally fits with what we're doing. I mean, we're seeing the museum idea much less as a kind of glass case at the center of something and more as a kind of a hub of an interconnected network of individuals, organizations, communities who know and love the canoe in a contemporary context.
So that really ties into, you've been doing a lot of work around reconciliation, and this really sort of speaks to trying to get away from the sort of cultural appropriation of artifacts and getting people to use this as kind of a nexus of their interest in canoes, and then that nexus branches out into the world of canoeing in all sorts of cultures.
Absolutely. And the welcome that we have had from some of the communities, many of the communities to which we have returned, has been staggering in a lot of ways in its generosity. It turns out, though, that if you want to go about business in a different way like that, that you've got to put almost everything on the table, including conventional hurry up and get it done by tomorrow timelines, because some of these, it's about relationship building, and that's not something you can force or catalyze with anything other than time spent together building understandings and common knowledge.
That was James Raffin from his Tumble home in Peterborough, Ontario. So here we are at the end of this episode of Harris Smith Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please consider subscribing to this podcast on Apple iTunes or in your favorite podcast player. And please tell your friends and family. Got feedback? We'd love to hear it. You can email us at letters@harrismithmag.com. That URL, harrismithmag.com, is also where you can order subscriptions online. And you can find Harris Smith Magazine on selected newsstands across Canada. Until next time, for Harris Smith Radio, I'm Wayne McPhail. And also, until next time, remember these four words: make, grow, sustain, share. Tune in for the next episode of Harris Smith Radio.